Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 89. Larry, it's 11 from 100. This is episode 89 of Registry Matters.
Do you think we'll make it to 100?
Based on your experience of, you've crossed 100 at least twice already. I think we will make it to 100.
I hope so. That'll be shortly, less than 3 months. So,
yes, it's 11 weeks away. Yep. Maybe something special is going to happen. Wink, 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 nod, nod.
I think we're going to reach the, 100 podcast supporters by then.
That would be amazing. That's a pretty strong stretch goal. Anybody want to take us up on that particular deal? We would love dollar a month. Patreon support, it would go a great long way to make Larry a very happy camper in doing this podcast every week.
Is that the beggar? Don't we have a beggar level?
There is an indigent level.
That's a dollar.
I did it based on, I went online and I found how to categorize people locked up. And so it was like indigent and then it was like hustler. I'm sorry, the second level was beggar. And then the third level is a hustler, and the fourth level, I guess, is supported. Yeah. So $1 a month, piece of cake.
Beggar is a couple or $3 a month.
It'd be $3. Yeah. And then, hustler would be $5. And then I think 15 is the support. And then there's the new level that we added, for those with like big pockets, and, that gets them some time with you if they want it.
That's true. And then we have a level that no one's matched yet, which is either their gross or net pay.
No, that's not true. Mike said last time that he did do it because he was unemployed.
Well, it has to be an amount of some sort. It has to be a gross of something.
All right. We have so much content tonight that we should just get going. And to start things off... We have, I think you said it's three major decisions that have come down the pike in the last, in this last week, at least since the last recording of this, that we have the one from North Carolina, we have one for, I don't know where Derek Logan, I guess that would have been out of Florida, and then a Tenth Circuit decision. Can you give us a quick rundown on what those things are about?
And they are actually in the last couple of days. The North Carolina decision came yesterday, and that has to do with... It's an old case that's been around for a number of years involving Grady, which Grady was subject to GPS monitoring after he had left supervision, and he contested that. And the courts in North Carolina gave him the middle finger. He took it to U.S. Supreme Court, and they said, of course, it's a search and seizure. So they remanded it to determine if the search and seizure was reasonable. Then it went back through the court system, went back to the lower court, and just made its way back to the North Carolina Supreme Court. So that was a favorable outcome. We'll talk about that more later. Then the one that I'm really excited about, I'm excited about all of them, but what I'm really excited about is First Amendment. That involves Derek Logue. And those who listen to the podcast, some know, some don't. Derek is an advocate. I believe his website is Once Fallen. And he has been in the trenches for a long time, and he's a little bit on the bombastic side when it comes to being in your face. But as those who've listened to this podcast for a long time know that I'm a big protector of that. Derek won at the appellate level court in Florida, where the judge had granted an injunction to a powerful state senator named Lauren Book. And Derek had found the resources and effected an appeal. And he prevailed, and we'll talk about that in more detail. And then the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals, U.S. Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the Rocky Mountain region where I'm located, they decided on a case involving what was perceived to be a blanket ban on use of the internet. And the Tenth Circuit has said repeatedly, again in this decision, that you just can't do that. It can't be a blanket ban. So we got three cases to unpack later. So great news.
Outstanding.
And I'm excited about it.
And what we're going to do is, because we have so much other stuff to cover as well, we're going to give the regular, the very much appreciated listeners, an introduction of what has gone on. And then for the Patreon supporters, hint, hint, go sign up at Patreon and you can go download this episode just for a buck and you'll get a big, strong, deep analysis, which Larry is incredibly proficient at doing. And that's why you are hired and paid the big bucks at doing this.
Correct. I'm the guru, I think.
You are, you know, in Patreon, I'm the HMFIC, but I'm not really the HMFIC. You are totally in charge of this whole thing.
So gracious, but I don't think so.
You are the only one that I know of that can do this job, Larry. And I mean that with the utmost sincerity, that I cannot think of anybody else that can cover these subjects with the depth and breadth and covering both sides and with the way that you articulate the points. I don't know of anybody else that could do it. Not even close.
Have you checked in the hospices and in the nursing home lately?
I haven't looked around that hard yet. No. But the first article that we have comes from thefire.org. And it's kind of an interesting concept here. The American Bar Association must reject guilty until proven innocent affirmation consent resolution. So is the American Bar Association saying that, oh, this is about people consenting to having sex, that you must have like positive confirmation that you and the person that you are about to do the sheet surfing with, that you guys have agreed to it? And what are you supposed to do? Get a written contract?
At the very minimum, you need a video before you need to.
Because that won't go south at all.
You need a video expressing the consent.
You need
a video of the consent. But this is an example of what happens when an organization matures and becomes so large as the ABA, and their primary mission becomes staying alive and prospering rather than what they originally, I think, I'm not old enough to remember when they started, but they now have this, they want to be mainstream. And this is the position of the Me Too movement, that consent has to be really, I mean, it has to be affirmative consent by someone who's able to give consent. And this resolution is opposed by the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, which is an organization that I'm an associate member of. And I would value they do a whole lot more fighting for justice and due process than ABA does. But this is the way things are headed.
I'm confused. This is the only subject where this is like two people entering into a contract in a very, very, very casual fashion. And I just don't see, how are you supposed to do this? I guess I've heard at colleges, they're even handing out forms in maybe like the student initiation packets that'll be like, hey, are we about to have the sex thing? And hey, can you sign here? It's like, no spontaneity, no romance, no seduction. It's just like, hey, we're going to I'm baffled by this. I'm baffled, baffled, baffled.
I haven't read ABA Resolution 114, but according to the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, it shifts the burden of proof by requiring an accused person to prove affirmative consent to each sexual act rather than requiring the prosecution to prove lack of consent. Now, I've always grown up believing that you're presumed innocent, and that the accusers and the prosecution bore the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt each and every element of the offense. But now we've been chipping away at that so long with the burden shifting and with strict liability offenses. So the resolution assumes guilt in the absence of evidence regarding consent. This radical change in law would violate the due process clause of the 5th and 14th Amendments and the presumption of innocence. But I mean, who cares about that kind of thing? I mean, there's pervs out there. We've got to shut these people down.
And I'm thinking about is it Brock Turner, the Judge Persky thing?
Yes,
is
that, yes, that's Brock Turner.
That case was. Yeah. Okay. That feels like what this is designed, that, you know, what this is based off of, is that you have a completely inebriated girl. And so she would never have, but I mean, she could still consent. She's just inebriated. And here, judge, here's the document that she signed. Yes, she was stoned out of her mind. She was drunk beyond her wits.
It's just very simple, Andy. You need to have a breathalyzer and toxalyzer with you. You need to have a drug testing kit so you can say, now, are you under the influence of any type of substance, prescribed or non-prescribed, you need to have the video rolling, and you need to ask them that, and you need to make sure you preserve that video. You need to take the specimen so you can run it through the lab. So you need to hold your hormones until you get the lab specimen back, unless it's a quick test, which they do make those that you do a quick test. But you have to make sure you have a good, reliable quick test, and you know how to interpret what you're reading. But I mean, this is absurd. But it's the ABA, in my opinion, catering to the mob mentality because it's in their business interest to do so.
God, I see just so many problems. I just see so many ways that this backfires. You have like, what's the word? Buyer's remorse. There's a different term for it. You know, the next morning you're like, oh crap, what did I do? So now you find the contract and you tear it up. No, I never gave consent. Where's the evidence? There's so many ways for this to backfire.
Well, the ABA will probably adopt the resolution. Let's see, when was it supposed to happen? It says just in a few days. It may have already happened.
And Brenda says that they tabled this, and the article is from the 5th, so it is possible because we're, you know, whatever, 10 days past that. So, all right, well, then let's move on, and let's dive into real quick and talk about Mr. Logue. And so, as I understand it, he has had an ongoing feud with Lauren Book, who is the daughter of Ron Book, who is our favorite person in the movement. And I say that with a lot of sarcasm. And I guess she had filed some sort of like a restraining order, and that would violate his ability to go move about and see her do appearances and whatnot?
That is correct. It's a short read of only 8 pages, and we'll have it in the show notes with some highlights made but she asked for a restraining order because she cited 3 incidents that gave her consternation. Well, but the problem for her is that she's a public figure, and you don't have a right not to be consternated when you're a public figure. You just don't enjoy such a right. People can show up and they can heckle you. I don't advocate for heckling and talking over people when they're speaking, but people can hold signs outside your event. The signs can be very critical of you, but she sought and received an injunction from a trial court in Florida, and she cited 3 incidents that just caused her great conflict. One was the Tallahassee protest. I think that was called Rally and Tally, and Derek showed up there. And you have to give Derek credit. He's a very resourceful guy, and he does do things that are a little bit outside the box. But he
different is a good word.
He finds he finds the way and the resources to do things that no one else will do. And the second,
he will definitely go out there and do things that other people will not.
But he
do,
also finds
sure.
the resources to go places on a very limited income. Right. He finds the resources to do and show up at places. And then the second incident was at the film festival in New York. For screening of a documentary, and he sat 3 rows behind her. and it says when the appellate took the microphone, which would be Derek, he asked the appellee, "How could you sit there and talk about how people in the registry don't deserve a second chance when your father is a convicted criminal and he got a second chance?" That's a legitimate. That's that's legitimate for public discourse. That should not.
Of course.
That should not consternate you at all. You should be able to say yes. He got a second chance or defend your position, but what you did doesn't deserve. I mean, there was nothing wrong about that. There was nothing wrong about showing up in Tallahassee with signs. And the third incident, the incident she cited was on social media. She says that his postings and tweets consternated her, but he didn't make any threats to her. So it says that the testimony established that the appellate maintained a website and other profiles on social media platforms professing his opposition to sex offender legislation. That's his right. The appellate posted the appellee's home address and pictures of her home on his website. That's his right. On other social media platforms, the appellate also posted a video with a song containing an obscene title and lyrics, as well as a cartoon depicting a tombstone with obscene reference to the appellee. He tweeted that the song perfectly depicted the appellee. However, the appellant neither directly communicated with the appellee about these posts nor sent them to her or any of her associates by email, text, or otherwise. So
is how similar is this? And send me all your hate mail, but you know, Trump has banned people on social media, and that has been pushed back against. And then describing what you've just done is Trump retweeted somebody making a video of when he was doing WWE or WWF, whatever it was, and body slamming somebody, and CNN is pictures on the person's face. How different is this than that?
I think I'm going to duck that one.
But I mean, from a First Amendment, so they said that Trump can't ban people because he's POTUS. If it were private citizen Trump, he can ban all the people he wants. So this sounds like a direct parallel.
She is not a private citizen.
And then the other thing that you were just describing was some sort of, you know, meme mock-up video, whatever. It's the way that you've just described it sounds like the CNN thing with Trump. So, but yeah, go ahead and duck. So send me the hate mail.
But yes, the court concluded that she proved that she was in fear of the appellant, but her subjective fear cannot be the basis for an injunction's issuance. Courts apply a reasonable person standard, not a subjective standard, to determine whether an incident causes substantial emotional distress. We'll get into it more later in a deeper dive. But
yeah,
but this is so important because speech you disagree with doesn't magically become illegal. But just remember, it cuts both ways. The people who support sex offender legislation, they have the same right, and I would vigorously defend their right as well. They have the right to say that they believe in whatever they believe in. That's their right in America, to believe in things and advocate for their position.
All right. And then another article that we have that came from the Florida Action Committee is the 10th Circuit rules special conditions allowing probation complete discretion over internet use is excessive. That is really hard to read. And this says that they can't make blanket bans on internet usage?
That is a 10th Circuit, and that's the Rocky Mountain region, which covers a number of states. I can't cite all of them, but this is
Colorado, Kansas, New Mexico, Oklahoma, Utah, and Wyoming. How about that?
That's good. You must be looking at the website.
So, no, I did it from memory. No, I did not.
So the special condition was so unclear that it appeared as though that the person would have to see their probation officer before they could access anything, rather than the other way around. It was presumptive that banned for the internet, and that there was nothing in the sentencing order that instructed that he be granted access to the internet. I mean, he only had 700,000 images.
Geez.
So that was all.
Just 700,000?
That was all, yes.
That's a lot of images.
I don't know what you would do with how long you'd store that many. But this special condition, the three-judge panel, two of the three, one didn't agree. And this is kind of funny. I'll just say I was talking to Ashley, who's the New Mexico Liberty and Justice staff attorney, and asked her to take a gander at the decision so that we could talk about it and put it in her inventory of decisions of things we might want to challenge based on it. She says, well, it's a really good decision. She said, but what? There was a dissent in there, and she said it was a relatively scathing dissent. And she said, we need to keep an eye on that judge. Well, Ashley's a little younger than I am, and she doesn't know Bobby Ray Baldock. And he's a senior judge. He's been on the Court of Appeals for a very long time. He sat as a district judge in the District of New Mexico back in the mid-80s. And I'm well aware of Bobby Ray Baldock. And, of course, what would the chances it would be that Baldock would be on the panel? And I said, well, I'll take a look and see who it was. Well, I called her Dane. I said, well, that was a good old Bobby Ray Baldock, the one that I told you about. He had when he was a district judge, a person appeared for sentencing. He had two speeches that he gave if you were before him. And in the federal system, they do not accept. I don't know of any judges that accept a negotiated sentence where their hands are tied. They'll accept a range, in terms of making an agreement with the U.S. attorney that you're going to get a specific sentence, they don't accept those plea agreements. Well, Bobby Ray would sentence the person almost to the maximum every time, and he would tell people if you had no criminal record, he would say, well, the power vested in me as a United States district judge, it's my duty to send a clear message to those who would break the law, not to break the law. So I'm sending a clear message here today, and I'm going to give you close to the maximum. He seldom maxed anybody out, but he would give them a very harsh sentence. Well, that was a speech if you had no criminal history. You got a very harsh sentence. If you had criminal history, then he just slightly revised it. powers invested in me as a district judge. It's my duty to send a message to the community about the acceptance of criminality. You've had a previous chance or multiple chances, so therefore, I'm going to impose a very harsh sentence on you. So that's what Bobby Ray did, regardless of whether you had criminal history or not. As an appellate judge, he seldom finds any problem with anything that the law enforcement apparatus is doing. He seldom finds any problem with what prison officials are doing. If you draw him on your panel, you can go ahead and count him out of going to, I can't think of, at least Scalia had a couple of niche areas where he would actually be on the defendant's side. With Baldock, right. I can't think of anything where he's ever on the accused side. So that's a good decision for us out of the Tenth Circuit. It's not binding if you live in any other circuit, but the body of case law in the Tenth Circuit is becoming overwhelming on this issue of a complete ban on the internet. So this is good stuff for future development of this issue and future challenges.
And at least in my feeble memory, so there was one from West Virginia, and then we have Packingham, and this one, I'm sure there's another one or two that I'm missing.
Oh, there's a number, yes.
They said,
yes.
Yeah. And I mean, you've all along said, look, they can't make an outright ban, but we still need someone to challenge it. We still need someone to try and run it up the flagpole to get someone to challenge it. You need to get well-funded, and you need to get a good case, blah, blah, blah. But still, here we are with another one. This one doesn't even sound like it's that good of a case if you... 70,000 images.
Well, I mean,
or 700,000. Whichever.
Let's see if it was 70 or 700. It was enough to where it caught my eye. That was a large number of images. I mean, but what's the difference when you're looking at them? Whether it's a few or a lot. So, it was 700,000. I thought I had it right the first time. So on page two, 700,000.
So sweet, 700,000 images of minors.
Yes, but now explain this to me, being that you're a techie guru. If you have an hour and a half video, how many images does that video contain if it's action of an hour and a half? Do you make a frame out of each? What?
Well, you technically could. I mean, it's 24 frames per second, and, you know, 90 minutes times that many seconds, it's 86,400 seconds in a day. Yeah, I mean, you could, if you had every one of them count as an image, sure.
Okay, so that. Well, in the
technically, I don't know that works that way, though. But I mean, it could.
If you're in the federal system where your case was decided if you had a federal charge, these cases are very helpful to you because you don't have to go to federal. You don't start it. If you've got a state conviction in Georgia, you've got to generally exhaust your state remedies before you go into federal court as a general rule. You're already in federal court if you're on a federal conviction. And as a general rule, the public defender's offices in the federal system are better funded than state apparatuses, which means, like in the case of this guy named Blair, he had the ability to go to his local public defender. And they raised this challenge to his special condition of supervised release. So those in the federal system have an advantage that if they do lack funds, they do have a better funded entity to turn to. Not saying that everybody who has a beef with their federal terms of supervision are gonna have the public defender jump through hoops for them. But on something significant like this, you have a better chance of getting help in the federal system, even if you're indigent.
Let's move over to our only article from the appeal tonight. And, you know, so when you know that we have the appeal, they're kind of long. This one doesn't seem that long, but it says Epstein's death reveals culture of indifference in jails. And we could then couple this with all of the other articles. I think I saw the autopsy report that just says that the coroner found that he died by hanging. But I did see one in the last day or so that's like, yeah, you could have. Like the fractures in his neck said that suggested that, yeah, it was strangulation, but not typically done by hanging yourself. So like, and it fired up all the conspiracy theories. The point, though, is that when we find someone to be accused of a thing and we put them in jail, they're already done for. We don't care. That's what the point of the article is.
Well, there's been a lot of discussion about the There's always indifference in prison settings. I've said, to the chagrin of some of our listeners, that the best people out there that have the best of intentions when you're growing up, you very seldom can you say, well, as I grew up, I heard of my friends saying they aspire to work in a jailhouse. I mean, can you think of anybody in your life that when you grew up, that when they talked about what they wanted to be, can you remember working in a jailhouse coming up?
No, not too often. You were generally like superhero, police officer, fireman, astronaut, those kinds of things.
Well, so the brightest among us do not aspire to work in correctional facilities. Now, having said that, I'm not saying that good people are not in correctional settings. They absolutely are a lot of good people working in correctional settings. But the best and brightest among us don't aspire to be in these settings. The good ones get burned out because what happens, and you being in a correctional setting, you know this to be true because you've been there. What happens is when there's a good officer on the unit that actually has a heart, they get overwhelmed and deluged with requests because the good officer will actually take the time to check on something for a person that seems important. And first, you know, the good officer is just overwhelmed with notes to do this, to check that, to do this and do that, and to go get them something that they can fit into because the pair of underwear they got is three times their size, and it goes on and on with different things that they're asked to do. So the good people that do manage to surface in correctional settings are quickly burned out and overwhelmed. And they're also ridiculed by the officers, the more jaded officers say, what the hell are you doing? This is not the Holiday Inn here. So you have a culture of indifference, like the article refers to. And then as we've been in hiring freezes, and that it's been surfacing more lately about the high level of vacancy in the BOP system, that correctional facility had a pretty significant vacancy level, which meant people were working overtime, and they were even putting people in positions that really wasn't what their training was, just to have a body there. Those things are not safe correctional practices. You can't have untrained, overworked people and run a safe and secure institution for everyone, including the inmates.
Let me put this to a different example, though. This just doesn't happen in prisons. When I was doing time in the military, not doing time, when I was in the military, anybody who surfaced as being someone that could organize things better, someone that was good at their job, someone that presented well, they get tacked on with extra duty stuff, where someone that's a little bit schleppy, someone that doesn't show up quite early enough for work, they just have to go do quote unquote their job. And, you know, the military pay structure is everyone gets the exact same pay per their rank, per their years. And then you start burning out people that can produce. Sounds like a very similar situation on the prison side.
I suppose so. That's going to cause me to go off on a tangent about the military, because the military is one of the most socialistic experiments ever devised in the history of mankind. And it's funny how people that serve in the military tend to lean very much toward the conservative politically. And I said, wait a minute, you're in the most socialist experiment ever devised. You get your pay not on your individual performance, but on your E ranking. You get extra money if you have a spouse and children. You get additional money, and your health care. This is socialism at its finest. But anyway, that wasn't the purpose of the podcast. But the people who excel in socialism at its finest are fighting against socialism. It's kind of an irony, isn't it?
Absolutely. But I get why, you know, we're off on a tangent going, but I just, if you at your job, if you excelled, your boss would be like, hey, we would like to promote you up and we will give you these bonuses and more money, et cetera. Another person that listens to the podcast was on a fast track for like a Fortune 100 company before he got jammed up. And he was, you know, on his way to making a very healthy six-figure income because he is that much of a hard charger and a producer. Whereas in these more social type, you know, here it is government. I mean, there's not much of another way to put it. And, you know, if you produce more, then you get burned.
Well, the heart of the point I was making more directly was that their good heart is totally burned out by the overwhelming of what's piled on them, because the good officers are there, but they are just totally inundated with requests, because the people, they zero in on them right away. The old codger that won't give them the time of the day, and then they get an officer that seems to care and have a heart, and all of a sudden that person is just overwhelmed with stuff to do for folks, and they burn out, and they cycle through these systems. But this institution, as many others in the Bureau of Prisons, apparently have suffered from the hiring freeze because, you know, we've had, although we're supposed to have the best economy of all time with gushing money, we're on the track record to hit a $1 trillion budget deficit this year. And they've been suppressed in their hiring and told not to hire people for some time now. Well, I mean, I'm just citing the facts. You saw the numbers last week. You saw that we're at, what was it, $880 billion so far this year? And there's still 2 months to go.
Thanks, everybody, for listening to the podcast, and we'll see you in the next whatever. All right. No, I'm with you. I totally understand. But the numbers are different. They don't count this time. It's different.
Well, no, of course they don't count. They never do, depending on who's in power in the White House. It's the budget deficit's blamed on if you have the D label. And then regardless, it's a congressional deficit where the D's run the Congress. When you had the Reagan presidency with Democrat, it was the Congress, the tax and spend liberals. Then magically, we had a surplus under a Democratic president, and then the president magically did not get any credit for the surplus. But then magically, when we swing the deficit again, it's all of a sudden, it's just situational. With Obama, he inherited a $1 trillion+ deficit and a collapsing economy and brought the deficit down to $400 billion. Now we're about to surpass $1 trillion, and it's nobody's fault now. It's just amazing. But anyway, the budget deficit has been a part of the hiring problem because the executive branch has issued agency orders to curtail hiring to try to contain spending because they need more spending for other areas that are more priorities. And I don't guess the prisons are as much of a priority up until this high-profile incident.
The next two articles are, I guess we should just kind of run them together, is from The Crime Report and then also from Time Magazine, talking about wrongful convictions. And the article from The Crime Report is, Can We Prevent Wrongful Conditions? And the Time Magazine article is, The Wrongly Convicted, Why More Falsely Accused People Are Being Exonerated Today Than Ever Before. Since we've been doing this podcast, I probably kind of didn't care prior to my whole interaction with this whole shit show of a system. I was just ambivalent, didn't know, couldn't really formulate an opinion on it. But the thought to me of someone actually spending one day in prison or in jail that is wrongly convicted and accused really has gotten under my skin to the point that it makes me angry and kind of like gets my blood boiling. And here we have, and this only, I guess, has only been being tracked for a couple decades now. And it says the National Registry data shows that the numbers have grown from just 24 in 1989 when it started to between 152 and 179 in the period between 2014 and 2018. 73 have been registered so far this year. We have people spending time in prison or in jail that ultimately did not commit the crime that they are accused of. And this typically happens more so to minorities with false eyewitness testimony. And I'm not saying this, but, you know, they all look alike. So this is atrocious that we would do this.
Well, I tend to agree. It says in the article that Texas has led the way with exonerations what is it, 360, 300 something exonerations.
Right. Yeah.
And you wouldn't expect New York, but it says was third. And of course, maybe population.
Wouldn't that just be because they have the most population?
These large states. But we're not going to have a perfect system. So guilty, innocent people will be convicted. This is the reason why I rant so much about the erosion of due process, because it is supposed to be hard to convict a person of a crime. You're trying to put them in a cage, boys and girls.
Yeah.
It is supposed to be hard to put a person in a cage. It was designed to be extremely difficult because the founding fathers, as they were called, they recognized that the state would have far more power than the individual and far more resources. It is supposed to be hard to put people in cages. And the easier we make it to put people in cages, the more people we're going to have in cages that are innocent.
How much of the Texas thing do you think is because it says they pay $80,000 a year for every wrongful imprisonment? You get locked up for, you know, 5 years, whatever, 80, that's what, 320? That they would pay out $320,000 for your wrongful imprisonment? That's a pretty steep penalty for them getting that wrong.
Well, hopefully that inspires an effort to exonerate people. Right now, the system where there's nothing in it for the attorney, it has to be your good heart. But I would just about guess that Texas pays $80,000 for every year. I would just about bet there's some split on that between the legal team. I would imagine that if they work 4 years trying to overturn your conviction, I doubt they'll do that pro bono when you're getting ready to walk away with hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yeah, maybe it's, you know, like the ambulance chasers where they keep a third or, you know, maybe a half or something like that.
So
there is, over on the Time magazine side, there's a chart that talks about the racial bias. And first of all, I've been challenged on this before. The population of African Americans in the United States is somewhere around 12 or 13%. That's what they present here. The inmate population is almost 50-50. It's 59, 38. It's like the disparity there is huge for having that many African Americans blocked up. But then the exonerations is the key point here. 47% of the exonerations are from African Americans. So they are at a much higher rate convicted of crimes, and then on the backside of that, they are much higher rate exonerated for, you know, for whatever reason, false testimony or bunk evidence, whatever.
We could spend an entire podcast about the disproportionate representation of minorities in our prisons. There's extreme right wing who says they should not commit as much crime. And there are people like me who say that there's a significant system bias that convicts.
And maybe it's a combination of both, at least. But
I was going to say, there, when you have lack of economic activity, if you buy into the theory that crime is motivated, many crimes are motivated by economics, that would stand to reason that there would be people who would commit crimes for economic reasons. If you buy into the belief that everybody has an equal opportunity and you should just simply pull yourself up by your bootstrap, the rugged American, I think you've seen the posters of the rugged American individual. I think it's a little mythical, but if you believe that everything is equal and everybody has an equal chance, I don't believe that. I believe that we do better than some countries and we do worse than others in terms of giving people equal opportunity. And if you grow up in the ghetto, you don't have equal opportunity.
Sure. Will in chat says, would it be any different if prosecutors weren't nearly bulletproof with immunity? What do you think, Larry?
I think it probably would be. Where do you draw that line, though, in terms of immunity? Because you can't, looking at it from the prosecution side, you can't have a prosecutor that's fearful that everything they do, that they might get thrown in jail and held accountable. But where you draw the line, where they have total immunity, as Will is asking, I think there's some area. I think there's some room to go back and revisit the immunity. But I don't think you can have no immunity for official actions. You're going to make mistakes, even operating with the best of faith. You know, you don't personally investigate every case. Cops that have years and decades of training bring things to you, and they tell you that their expert says this, and that we've got this guy dead to rights. He confessed. We followed the book. And prosecutors often prosecute bad cases because they don't know they're bad cases. So,
but I'm thinking of a military parallel where, you know, you send off some soldiers to go do something and they end up doing, you know, Abu Ghraib pictures. They're not immune from prosecution for those things, but many things you would not hold them accountable for because they were given an order. It's kind of sketchy. They followed the order, but you know, it was in the interest of battle, whatever. Prosecutors, if it's an honest mistake, shouldn't the prosecutor backtrack and try and make everything right? But we constantly hear about withholding evidence or, you know, just trying to put their thumb on the scale, et cetera. We have to be able to go back and challenge those things.
Well, you hear about the extreme when they withheld evidence, but there's a lot of the cases where you don't hear about the extreme, where the prosecutor in good faith believed that they had a solid case, the defense attorney believed they had a crappy case, and the jury bought the prosecution's version. Cases, when they do go to trial and the situations where a trial has happened, each side has a theory of the case. And when I'm saying a prosecutor, cases are extremely complex these days. We live in a digital and a very complicated world. This ain't like back in Abe Lincoln's days when crimes were witnessed by someone, and they came in and said, I seen him do it. We have a vast amount of experts now. We have everything from your cell phone location to the forensics that were collected at the scene of the crime. You don't have simple trials anymore. So there are a whole lot of people involved in a case now that wouldn't have been 30 years ago. And the prosecutor doesn't personally know all this stuff that are involved in the case. They're being told by the experts that this person did do this, that our tests revealed that they are the culprit, and they believe in that. I'm saying that when they are acting in good faith, we can't penalize them if they got it wrong acting in good faith. We can reexamine their immunity and we do. You remember the Duke, was it Duke University where the lacrosse team?
Yes,
yeah, the Duke lacrosse yes, team. The prosecutor there acted in total bad faith and suffered consequences. We need to see more of that. But prosecutors are but one player in the system. They have a role to play. When the system works properly, the prosecutor follows their ethical requirements and they seek justice and they go forward with good cases where they have solid, they believe they have solid evidence, and they don't go forward where they're throwing up crapshoots. Now, that's not the way it actually happens in real life. Prosecutors, depending on where they're in the country, they'll throw up a crapshoot because they know that their jurors are not going to be very critical and they're not going to be hesitant to return a conviction because the police say this is a bad guy. You take places where I think I've said many times, try to get a drug conviction in Boulder or Denver and tell me how well you do. you just can't get a jury to return verdicts on simple drug possession. They don't even bother anymore because the citizens. But you take that case to Houston County, Georgia, those exact same facts, you'll have no problem getting a conviction. Because by golly, they're out there protecting us, and they broke the law, and we're gonna return a guilty verdict. That's our duty.
Just before I was released, they were voting in the House about doing the CBD oils and to try and stop seizures, and they turned it down. And I was just like, you people are assholes. You've got a guy here in the state that's trying to get this oil so his kid stops having seizures. She's having dozens of seizures per day. You are now forcing this man to go traffic drugs across state lines so that his kid can lead something of a normal life. And I'm baffled at the mindset there that you wouldn't at least make medicinal marijuana use, the CBD oil, something that the guy could get.
But
it was unbelievable.
But you know, the funny thing is that until that person personally experienced that, that person would have been, in all likelihood, one who is, I don't want all that damn gateway dope coming in, because this is the beginning of the end. This is a slippery slope. Those people magically have an epiphany when they start experiencing pain or they have a sick child. They magically, like our former sheriff, Darren White, if you're listening, you magically had an epiphany. When you were the secretary of the Department of Public Safety, you claimed that drugs should be illegalized and people should not be legalized, and that people should pay the maximum penalty. And you claimed you resigned from the cabinet secretary ship under Governor Johnson because of that strong belief. Now you're in the marijuana business. You own a growery now and a dispensary, and you're advocating for, because magically you've experienced the pain from an injury, and you're finding that this actually cannabis helps you. But for all these years, you were on the wrong side of the issue. Well, that's where most people usually come down. They're the problem until they're the problem for the misguided policy, and they don't see the misguided of the policy until it affects them in a personal way, and then magically they do an epiphany, which is better than not ever doing an epiphany at all. I mean, I'm glad that Darren White is advocating for cannabis now, but it's tragic that he was so harsh for so many years when he had not seen the light.
I'm fairly convinced that on the prosecutor side, the incentive structure has to change. If they are only going to be held accountable in the election cycle for convictions, then all they're going to do is go seek convictions. However they get there, it doesn't matter. They have to be like, and probably by the time someone ends up to be released from some sort of exoneration, that prosecutor is probably already gone, so then it doesn't matter. But they have to be held accountable somehow to doing a bad job. And I mean, and I don't mean bad job by not getting convictions, by doing a job of any of these allegations, some sort of watchdog group, something of that nature to keep track of, to make sure that justice is being served properly.
Well, theoretically, they're held accountable by the voters who decide to keep them in office as the elected district attorney or the elected prosecutor of that district. So there's an accountability. Doesn't it come?
The timeline is so wrong. If it takes a decade or something to for somebody to get through enough appeals and to get someone to take the case, because, I mean, they're forgotten about. How would you hold a DA accountable that's only going to be there for, you know, whatever, 6, 8, 10 years, when it's going to take that long for something to come back around and bite them?
Well, except for in the smallest offices, it's not the DA personally that you're holding accountable. It's the office. The DA in a decent sized DA's office, they seldom handle their personal caseload. They're administrating and they're dealing with bigger issues. But I get your drift. The actual prosecutor's side of the case is long since gone.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's move on to the Marshall Project, because this is the novel article of the night. Novel as in the size of a novel. They got their voting rights back, but will they go to the polls? This profiles a handful of people in Louisiana, and I'm assuming that they recently changed a law there that allows them to go vote. And there are 37,000 Louisianians who have recently had their voting rights restored by the state legislature are joining a potential wave of voters. There's one guy, he's 58. He's been on parole for the past 30 years, so he's effectively never been able to vote. Now he doesn't even know what to do. He probably doesn't even know where the poll office is, or probably hasn't followed politics or anything. So even, and I'm sure this relates to the Florida thing where they changed the constitutional amendment, that how many of these people, A, are going to vote, and which team are they going to vote for? Does it just end up being a wash that they're going to vote roughly 50-50, and then obviously then those that don't even vote?
Well, this article illuminates the barriers that are being put in place to try to prevent these people from voting. You know, with like in Florida, they have to pay all their fees and fines, and so it's akin to a poll tax, according to the Marshall Project. And it says in Louisiana, the potential voters are consumed by the struggle to rebuild their own lives after prison. They must also combat apathy born of their ordeals. But I maintain that from my personal experience, that you're way overblowing what these people are at best. They're going to split 50-50. But all this notion you hear on conservative talk radio that this is a tidal wave of new Democratic voters, I just don't see it that way. Well, you were in prison. How many Democrats did you meet in prison when politics came up? How did people lean conservative or lean liberal in your prison?
I frankly think it split just by race. Like, typically white people were conservative and typically black people were Democrats. I mean, typically, but then you still would have to factor in people just don't follow it.
So, I know from personal experience with dealing with offenders, I find consistently that they lean conservative. And so I think that it's overblown, the fears. I think that actually that the conservatives ought to just welcome these people and reach out to them rather than being so terrified.
Interesting. And how is that? Does it matter? Louisiana, like, they might have an uptick of 10,000 voters out of the 37,000. Maybe it's only 5,000 and it makes no difference. Such a red leaning state anyway.
Well, it is, but it's strategically placed. A few votes can make a difference. Working with an attorney in Georgia now in a case where he's a mayor of a city in Georgia and he won by one vote.
Right. Yeah, totally. Yeah. So, I mean, it totally can happen. And and didn't the Bush-Gore election, didn't that come down to just 100 or something votes in Florida?
537, to be precise.
Okay. Oh, wow. Mr. I've got the exact number.
Yes, that was once the Supreme Court stopped the counting. It was 537. That's what.
So it could have been some radical different number, but that's where it was when it stopped.
Well, yeah, they used the old punch out ballots back in that was the election of 2000, and they used the old
the hanging chad
there were counties that were deciding whether or not the chad was all the way punched through, whether it would count. And then they had the butterfly ballot where you had to flip it over, and some people missed voting for the president or voting for some offices. So you had undervote. You had all this controversy, and the Supreme Court stopped the counting because there was no consistency, apparently. As I recall, this was now, 19 years ago? But because of the inconsistency in the counting process, they stopped it. So the Secretary of State, I think her name was Harris at the time. I can't remember her first name, but she certified the election with 537 votes in favor of Bush.
I have a mission for you. Since we are moving, you know, roughly whatever, 15 months to election next year, can you come up with a watch list of what to look for either on your local ballot or as you hear about things in the news? Should ballots be alphabetical? Should they be how they should be laid out, and what the different strategies may be? I'm assuming you're to some degree at least aware of it, if not involved in how the ballots get laid out in your state.
To some degree, yes.
So could you provide us with a to keep an eye on in the news, because these subjects are going to come up, I'm sure. I'm just, you know, you just described, so we had the hanging Chad thing, and you remember the picture of the guy with his glasses looking down and piece of paper up with a little punch out, not completely punched out, and they're trying to figure out voter intent. Then you had, like you were talking about, the butterfly thing. So then you had candidates split on either side. Maybe people didn't know to flip the ballot over, so people just like, where's my candidate? So they just, oh, I guess he's not running. It's an interesting conversation.
Well, there are different ways. Here, the candidates draw lots for ballot position. So you could end up at the bottom of the ballot, you could be the incumbent. And we don't mark incumbents. Georgia, last to my knowledge, does mark the incumbent. So that gives the incumbent an extreme advantage.
Oh, okay.
So we don't do that here. And then some states have where you can still vote a straight party ticket. We don't have that anymore either. So on election day, if you don't know anything, if you have a political party that you lean towards, you just say, well, I'll vote a straight whatever ticket. And that option's not available to voters in my state any longer.
Gotcha. I don't know how we missed this one from a few months back from Reason Magazine. Florida cops rearrest 26 sex offenders in Operation Karma. Their crime, not updating their car info. We're not going to spend much time on this, but this is asinine that you put people, lock them back up for not updating the car information. Seriously, they created a 3-day sting. This is awesome, Larry.
it's all the more reason why I say that we have to take registration out of law enforcement's hands, because it's a civil regulatory scheme and it needs to be put into a civil regulatory agency. What you have here is this Sheriff Judd, the Polk County Sheriff's Department. I believe it's Judd. Yeah, Sheriff Grady Judd. We have Sheriff Judd.
There could be a TV show, possibly.
Well on To Catch a Predator, he was. I believe his department was featured on To Catch a Predator.
Chris Hansen,
I believe, if I'm not mistaken, he was. But this is an example of a solution in search of a problem. There's a requirement, and this is probably better is to say this is I got you moments. If you build enough things in the registry requirements that they have to do, you eventually have an I got you moment, because you just can't get them all done quick enough. If you make it so difficult that you have to travel in person to report this, rather than, I mean, we are in the digital age. You could go online and you could enter the VIN number of your car, and you could notify them instantaneously that you have a new vehicle. But if you have this kind of crazy reporting system where you have to go to a sex offender office that's located in the sheriff bowels of the sheriff's office, that's only open on Monday afternoon from 1 to 4 and on Thursday afternoon from 9 to 1, and you have to take off a half a day's work to go do that, to sit in this room, it's the difficulty of complying that causes people to go non-compliant. Trust me, lawmakers, if you make it easier for people to comply, they actually will comply. If you make it more difficult for people to comply, there will be a lower rate of compliance. It's really just that simple. And the reason how I know this is because it's the same in your life. If they make the process for you to get a $10 rebate extremely difficult, you won't take the $10 rebate. If they make it extremely easy, where all you have to do is scan it through your what do you call it, if you do an image of it and you shoot, I mean, you will comply and say, well, I'll take advantage of that. It's just really that simple. If the object of registration is compliance, why don't you make it easier for people to achieve compliance?
If not for making it something to trip them up to rake them over the coals.
That's exactly, that's what I'm, this is actually not designed. It's actually designed with the intent of tripping people up. That's the entire point of it. When you have the Lauren Book and the Elizabeth Bartholomew's of the world out there, and the former Sheriff White, who's now the drug advocate, but he was as hard-nosed on the registry as anybody you could ever imagine. When you have those people out there, they're saying, let's make it tougher and tougher and tougher.
Yeah.
And what
it's funny, Will says in chat that this is the thing, he says this is the same asswipe that was preventing people from going to the hurricane shelters during in Florida last go around.
I'm not
so
surprised.
That's this guy.
I'm not surprised.
What are we going to do, Larry? How do we fix this?
Very carefully.
Got it.
Lots of work.
Yeah, definitely a lot
of
work.
Well, the first thing is to get it out of the hands of the cops.
That sounds like a great plan.
Yeah. Well, it's not going to be easy to achieve, but the registration must be removed from law enforcement because it is a civil regulatory scheme. It has no business being managed by the police departments and the sheriff's departments.
Does sound like a no-brainer to me. When you described that to me the first time, I was like, huh, that's a really interesting idea that you've put together there. I don't know if you are the originator of that idea, but that sounds like an amazingly
effective
idea.
I haven't heard a soul espouse that. All I've heard is I get hate mail and criticism. and it sounds like Larry is in favor of the registry, and he's talking about making it easier. And I'm saying, no, what I'm actually is that I've accepted that I'm not going to be able to get the registry to go away anytime soon. In acceptance of that, I believe that making life better for people is the next best thing to making the registry go away. Now, if you're happy with the status quo and you don't want to make life better, that's your personal choice. You can be happy with the status quo. But I'm going to try to do everything I can to save as many people's lives and make life better for as many people as I can. And I think that if we could take the registry out of the hands of law enforcement, that it would improve the quality of life because you wouldn't have the Gestapo raids of seven different agencies showing up with all this garb, pounding at your door, demanding to be let in because there's no basis. Can you think of a civil regulatory scheme where they pound at your door and demand to be allowed in with guns drawn?
Absolutely not.
Well, that's why it needs to come out of the hands of law enforcement. Now, whether it should exist, that's a separate discussion. I'm not saying it should exist. But the fact of the matter is, it does exist. Remember, I don't talk about the world the way it should be. I'm talking about the world the way it is be. We do have the registry. So the second best position we can take is to make it to improve the lives of as many people as we can.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
We are going to move over to DentonRC.com, an editorial piece. Larry, we could overlay this article with whatever was going on in like January, February, where people were dying in prisons from it being freezing cold. Here we go. Same thing, but it's hot. Dangerously hot prisons are flagrantly inhumane. This is only an editorial, so you know, your mileage may vary. But it says 22 people have died as a result of oppressive conditions at 15 state prisons since 1998, according to the Texas Department of Criminal Justice. And I know that I think the private prisons in Georgia are the only ones that are air conditioned. Otherwise, the state ones, man, you're just in open dorms. And it's been, I don't want to talk about the weather again, but it's been hot AF in this state for the last couple of weeks.
We've talked about this on the podcast last summer, maybe even the summer before, but we've talked about this before. And I ridiculed Texas immensely last year, and I'll do it again this year, that you people in Texas that think that it's enjoyable to inflict this type of inhumane treatment on people and the health consequences that flow from it. And I understand the first thing that they'll say is, well, Larry, you don't understand. There's poor people that live in Texas who don't have air conditioning. Yes, there are poor people who live in Texas and other states who don't have air conditioning. I get that. But they do have the ability to open windows. They do have the ability to have fans. They do have the ability to have a cold freezer with ice cubes. They do have things that you don't have. And they do have the ability to seek medical attention. They have options that a prisoner doesn't have. If you think that putting people in an oven serves some kind of a purpose, all it does is it causes your healthcare bills to go up. It causes your staff morale to burn out because, believe it or not, the humans that work in these institutions, they don't like this heat either.
And I bet you their control booth is air conditioned. Don't give me that. I mean, they have to go into the hot ass dorm, but their control booth is air conditioned at 40 degrees or something.
I'm sure that that's some truth in that. But when you work in a prison, you're not always in a control booth. You're walking cell blocks. You're escorting prisoners. You're sitting in chow halls. You're doing things in dealing with prisoners. You're on rec time. You're in the rec yard. But you're not just sitting in that air conditioned control booth. The administrators may have it. But it leads to burnout, turnover, health cost, and deaths. And you have a federal judge who's angry with you because you agreed to keep you the you agreed to a modest concession to not let the temperature get over 88 degrees. It had to be under 88 degrees. Now, can you imagine that? Most of us would not be too happy at 88 degrees. So the settlement agreement said that the Wallace Park unit near Navasota, which I have no idea where that is, but it would be kept under 88 degrees. And they flagrantly disregarded that agreement. And the judge,
I have an interesting story to share with you.
The judge said that the state has shown negligible interest, quote, in determining the conditions at the prison before sending inmates there, despite available evidence that temperatures inside the prison exceeded those set forth in the settlement.
I was having a conversation with a woman here in town that owns a business up the street from me, and I described to her that we could get ice, and she's like, "You could get ice? You shouldn't get ice." I was like, "Why not? Because you're there because you committed a crime, and you should be punished. And all this like gourmet food that you guys get and cold water, no, shouldn't happen." I was like, "You are out of your effing mind. Can't get ice?
What do you need ice for?"
It's like 100 degrees out today and it's going to be hot in the prison, and you like having cool water that comes out of an overtaxed water fountain, and then you, oh, man, come on.
Well, the former sheriff Arpaio, who's announced that he may run for sheriff again, he took great pride in saying that he kept the dog pounds air conditioned in Maricopa County.
But not the prison, because they were in a tent.
Yeah. And there's a quote in this article that says you can find dog pounds with better climate control systems than some Texas prisons. So
they didn't commit a crime, Larry, so they shouldn't have that kind of poor treatment.
It says it's not calling this article. It's not calling inmates to provide cells that are heated and cooled properly. That cost is an investment in rehabilitation that can help reduce recidivism and lower the more than $3 billion the state spends annually to house the nation's largest prison population. Remember, too, that guards and other staff members as well suffer as well when prison conditions are oppressive. That's what I was saying. But Texas, you people are something else. Thankfully, all of our institutions in this state are ventilated with proper climate control. You don't hear that as a gripe about our prisons. I doubt that everybody gets the ideal temperature that they would prefer, because it's a centralized system. But we don't have that complaint here in our prisons. They do have working ventilation at all of our units.
You wouldn't say that the people in Texas are sick, would you?
I would say yes, they are sick.
Is it the good kind of sick? Like, hey, that's cool.
I thought there was only one kind of sick. Is there more than one kind of sick?
There is now. There's total, like, somebody does a great big awesome backflip on their skateboard, like, man, that was sick. That's what they say now.
Okay, so yeah, well, that's not that kind of sick.
Different kind of sick. From Vice.com, here we go, Larry. We saw this coming. A tidal wave of sex abuse lawsuits is about to hit New York's Catholic churches and Boy Scouts. This is all about them removing the statute of limitations, Me Too movement, because they upped the civil suit part, I think, to like 50-something years. I'm not sure if that was also the criminal side. There are people coming out of the woodwork. There's actually another article that we have coming down with Marcy Hamilton talking about the exact same thing. This is going to be an amazing shit show of lawsuits that come down.
It absolutely is. And it says institutions like the Catholic Church have had lobbied against the role of the look-back window for good reason. After Minnesota opened its window, the Archdiocese of St. Paul in Minneapolis declared bankruptcy and paid $210 million to 450 survivors. A California widow led the Archdiocese of Los Angeles to pay 508 survivors a record $660 million. So it's not going to end.
Nope. Actually, she's mentioned in this article too. Yeah, it's going to be interesting. I mean, not just from the side with the Catholic Church, but anybody who the article we have, we can actually just bounce to it right now. Where did it go? That I guess it's just the next article. Yeah, it is. There's a woman who says that her janitor touched her 40 years ago. What is the janitor supposed to do? She said she told the principal. And the principal said, you know, just keep your mouth shut, go back to class. And nothing came of it. So here she is at the age of 51, says that this happened when she was 12. So 40 years ago, she's going to make a claim against somebody, I'm going to then guess, is probably dead.
Well, but the entity, the where it happened, is not dead.
The school?
Yeah.
Right. The school district, what, in the county?
This is not for criminal prosecution in this particular instance. This is to give the people economic settlement for the lifelong trauma that they've suffered. And there's no way to defend against this because the burden of proof is only a preponderance in a civil case as opposed to beyond reasonable doubt.
Can you remind me what that means, please?
It means slightly more than 50% if you have the scale balance.
Oh, okay.
So you have in a civil proceeding, the proof standard is so much lower. That's O.J. Simpson. He was found civilly liable for the Ron Goldman.
Right.
What was her name? Nicole Brown Simpson murder.
He was sounds good.
Found not guilty by the criminal the court, but he was found responsible in a civil proceeding. Well, when you bring something in decades later, I don't know whether the janitor fondled her when she was 11 years old. Nobody does. But I mean, she does, but nobody knows. No jury can sit and decide whether that happened with any degree of certainty.
Yeah, I don't see how you'd anybody like. Were they going to have any evidence? They certainly didn't have any security cameras, and even if they did, would they still have the storage of it? There's no way for this entity to defend itself, which even at the end of the article, they said they called the school district and the school district said they didn't have any comment. Of course they don't have any comment. What are they supposed to say?
There's nothing you can say other than if you said that you deny the allegations, that's being insensitive to the survivor. You can't even call them. I'm not even sure if you call them victims or survivors anymore. I'm confused on the terminology. I don't particularly care for the survivor term because to me it implies that there was a reasonable expectation you would die. When you have an airplane crash and a plane comes down from 35,000 feet and it crashes into land and you walk away from that, you survive something where the odds are that you were not going to survive. I think in the area of sexual offending, I think that most people do survive. So but I think that's the end term right now, is that there are survivors rather than victims, but maybe they're both. It's people
send hate mail to Larry.
People in chat can correct me on which or whether it's survivor or victim and where you distinguish what the political correct terminology is. But to me, you're a survivor if you were in a situation where you might die. The probability would be reasonably well that you would die. The people who were on the Indianapolis when it sunk and they were out of the ocean bobbing for about, 3 days before they were rescued. Those people were survivors. The ones that didn't get eaten up by the sharks. The ones that didn't drown from lack of water, from salt water is not very, it's not a very good option when you're out for days without any fresh water. But I just, the survivor thing just really hits me wrong, because there was no expectation you were not going to survive.
From the LA Times, the LA County Sheriff's top watchdog is under investigation by the LA County Sheriff's. I know you didn't see this movie, Larry, but there's a movie called Inception. And anyway, I won't even go into all that, but that's what this feels like. So you have the body that's watching the body being investigated by themselves. This is very incestual. This sounds very horky dorky. And this is very confusing to me.
What's confusing about it?
Why would the investigating unit be investigated by the unit that they're investigating? Wouldn't they then know what they're being investigated for? Like, all the records would be unsealed.
Okay, run that question. I like that question. Run that one more time.
All right. So the investigating body is being investigated by the body that they are investigating. Wouldn't they have all of the information already about what they're going to be investigated about?
Maybe the ones they're investigating think that they're doing something corrupt that needs to be investigated.
Maybe there should be an independent panel to investigate the investigators that are investigating.
This is too confusing.
You see, so anybody that knows the movie Inception will follow. It, also, M.C. Escher comes to mind too. This is very circle jerkish. That anyway, why doesn't somebody want to be investigated?
Well, I think we can figure that out, that if you don't be investigated, that I doubt anybody has a completely crystal clear, pristine. I mean, I know there's one on this podcast that does, but other than that one person.
But if you're not doing anything wrong, Larry, why would you have a problem being investigated? Isn't that what we always hear? You shouldn't mind being stopped or detained by the police, that because if you have nothing to hide, then just let them do their thing.
Well, I have heard that.
Do you have any idea, reading through the article, what they're being investigated about? Does it even matter for our purposes here?
I couldn't get a whole lot out of that article.
That's fine. I do find it funny, though, that the investigators are investigating the body. They're being investigated by the body that they are investigating. That just seems very, very kangaroo court-ish. Then we should move on to WYFF4.com. Richland County deputy caught. I love this, Larry. This is like, this should be like our moron article of the week. Richland County deputy caught in child sexting by his own department. Again, like talking about the previous article, the guy could have known that there was a sexting going on, and therefore he shouldn't be participating in what they're going to go sting. So this is not a very, very smart person. This is out of South Carolina.
Well,
he was communicating to have sex with a 15-year-old.
Let's be careful that we don't convict the person before. I mean, he enjoys the presumption, although he never affords anybody that presumption. You never hear a cop say, I mean, watch the old shows like Dragnet. I think we could probably, I'm blabbering, you could find an intro to Dragnet where they say all suspects are presumed innocent until proven guilty in a court of law.
Right.
That's old ancient history, but just be careful. This guy, we don't like perp walks, and we don't like the presumption of guilt. The fact that he was arrested, if he is guilty, it's kind of sad that the person that's enforcing the law is doing the same thing. But he certainly does enjoy the presumption of innocence, even though he probably never afforded anybody that same presumption himself.
I'm just intrigued that the guy working in the department may have gotten wind that the sting was going on, and maybe he had a certain arrogance of, psh, this isn't going to apply to me. I'll be able to get out of it.
I don't think it would be, I would be able to get out of it. People generally think that they're not going to get caught. The offender mind often thinks that they're just a tad bit smarter than the everyone else. I don't, have I ever told a story about the Albuquerque police setting up an escort service back in the 80s called Albuquerque's Finest, and they ran ads in the in the newspaper.
No.
Oh, this
You've
was
never
a,
told me this story.
This is a great one. They ran, this is a long time ago, people actually ran ads in newspapers at one time. I don't know that newspapers, probably nobody even subscribes to one anymore, listens to the podcast. But people, there was a lot of personal ads, and people ran ads, and the Albuquerque Police Department was looking for escorts. Now, of course, it didn't say Albuquerque's Police Department. It probably would have been very few people respond to the ad if they'd said that. But they did say, they did say Albuquerque's Finest Escorts. Now, you know, okay, the old adage about the police department being Albuquerque's Finest.
Yes.
Okay, so they ran an ad, and this guy, well, a whole lot of people answered the ad, but this one guy in particular, they featured on the news. He was so hilarious. He was, first of all, not that attractive. I don't think he would have earned a lot of money as an escort. But he told the police how smart he was to avoid detection by the police. Because they asked him, you know, they said, well, you seem like, you know, that you have the motivation and you could excel in this job, but, you know, we need people who are somewhat sly and can avoid it. He said, oh, you don't have to worry. He said, I'm steps and steps ahead of the cops. And they said, well, you sound like exactly what we're looking for. So they said, well, let's introduce you to the rest of Albuquerque's Finest. And they opened the door into the adjoining hotel room, and I had to walk to the uniform officers and be handcuffed. And so, but the point I was making is people think that they, it's like that when a person is hiring a prostitute, you're not a cop, are you? Well,
they have to tell you you're a cop. They can't lie to you.
Well, of course they can lie to you.
That's what I hear.
Yeah, of course they can lie to you. And when the person says, no, I'm not a cop, and then they get arrested. Well, this 34-year-old defendant, he may have been quite well aware. I mean, he may have known about this thing, but he figured that he was smarter and he was going to avoid it. And his cleverness, being a police officer, that he would not fall into the trap. And he apparently did. They have enough evidence that they felt that they arrested him.
clearly.
So
over on NBCNews.com, there's an article out of Wisconsin. It says 13 registered sex offenders in Wisconsin on GPS monitoring cannot be located.
Well, how could we have lost
13 people.
How could that be? I thought the GPS tracked you.
Perhaps they took them off. Well, perhaps they put tin foil around them.
So.
Perhaps they drained the battery and didn't recharge it. Maybe, you know what, maybe we should add like some sort of shocking mechanism to them so that if you try to disconnect it, it shocks the shit out of you, maybe?
Well, it says, and I was put in context, of 965 sex offenders on active supervision with Wisconsin Department of Correction who are mandated to be monitored, 13 cannot be located. That is not a significant number of percentage because, as you stated, there could be equipment malfunctions that would explain such a, I mean, what's the percentage on that? You're a mathematical genius.
965 and you've got 13?
Yeah.
That's like a tenth of a percent.
So I mean, I don't consider it to be anything that I would be overly alarmed about. One person allegedly cut off his GPS monitoring, but the rest of them could be just genuine equipment failures.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's just 1%, not 10%.
But,
I did that wrong.
But again, that's not a huge number when you got it.
No.
I will just about guarantee you with any technology at any given time, there's 1% of it malfunctioning.
I would pretty much agree with that. But if it saves one, Larry, it's worth it.
Well, then it may be saving one. I'm not going to be able to make that determination if it's saving one or not. But the point of this article is that they're trying to generate on the news all this panic about 13 people that should be GPS monitored, they're not being monitored because of whatever reason they're off the grid. As if somehow or another that means 13 people are committing offenses. It doesn't mean anything of the kind. We can't extrapolate anything from that.
Except for that we don't know where they are.
Right.
That is all we know.
That's all we know, but we can't extrapolate anything bad's happening. We'll have to wait and see if anything bad happens.
Certainly. And then they would be prosecuted for more crimes.
If something bad happens and it's tracked to them, yes. The GPS advocates would say that this is an investigative tool that helps them to narrow in on a suspect more closely. And they will argue that it helps you to be exonerated if you're not there. For example, If someone makes an obscene phone call or a prank phone call and makes a bomb threat from a, if, well, it started say from a payphone, but I don't know if you could even find a payphone anymore to make such.
Does anybody even listening to this know what a payphone is?
But if someone, if the location of the origin of the call is nowhere near you, you may have a history of making those type of telephone calls, and they can quickly exonerate you. So it does cut both ways. The GPS can also be your friend. But I'm not advocating for GPS that they should be strapped on everybody. Everybody who's listening to the podcast knows that I say that they have a proper role to play, which is a backup role, and there could be appropriate use. But they just slap these things, these devices on way too many people.
Abso-frickin-lutely. All right. Then maybe how about we cover this article from NARSL, which has a source over at another website. But this is the North Carolina decision that says you can't do lifetime GPS monitoring just because you are have committed another crime. That just you can't do it from a blanket reason. Did I sum that up terrible?
You did a fine job. So that we talked about that in the news bite. This is a little bit deeper dive on the case. It was decided August 16th, which was yesterday, in the North Carolina Supreme Court. The case of North Carolina versus Tory Grady, and the case has been in litigation for years and years and years, and it's finally gotten to a resolution. Because it's worked its way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court issued a decision in 2015, which it took years to get to the U.S. Supreme Court, but the U.S. Supreme Court issued a decision that North Carolina's argument that this was not a search and seizure was so ridiculously, it was just absurd, that of course it's a search and a seizure. So they remanded the case and said, go back and figure out if it's a lawful search, because all searches are not unlawful or unconstitutional. And so as it went back through the state court system, it went back down through the North Carolina court system, but eventually getting back to the trial court. And the trial court said, well, yeah, stand by my original order. You're going to have to be fitted for this GPS monitor for the rest of your life. So he appeals again and works his way back up to the highest court in North Carolina. So the statute is a significant one. They apply it to several categories of people, and if you look at page 3 on the decision, which we'll have marked, offenders who are on probation or parole are subject to or to any type of state supervision. Unsupervised offenders who remained under satellite-based monitoring by court order for a designated number of months or years. And unsupervised offenders who are also known as lifetime trackers. So there's like three categories, and he fit into that third category. He was an unsupervised offender, but yet they applied this to him because he was a recidivist. And Mr. Grady is the third of the categories. He's subject to satellite-based monitoring for life and is unsupervised by the state probation parole or any post-prison supervision. And he was persistent. He told them we talked about the case in Georgia, the Park case, where where Mr. Park told them they could take their GPS monitor and stuff it, you know, where. Well, this guy did the same thing. He told them, you can take your damn monitor and stuff it. I'm not going to participate in this program. And he was very persistent, and I don't know where he derived the resources. It looks like the appellate division of the North Carolina Public Defender's Office with Glenn Girding was the lead on this case, so it looks like he may have fought this all on public resources.
It does say towards the bottom of the article, it says the government interest outweighs the minimal intrusion upon diminished privacy interests. Like carrying around this little box on your leg, there's a picture in the article of somebody with one on there. It is not a minimal intrusion. It's right there on like your inside ankle. That would be super duper sensitive. Like, you know. Anyway, this would be very obnoxious, annoying, and not minimally intrusive. I mean, how do you go to the beach?
Well, the court didn't say that. The court found just the opposite, that they can't require him to do this. So I'm not.
But that's what who's Newby? Justice Paul Newby. I guess that would be the dissent.
Well, that would be the dissent. Yeah. So we don't care about the dissent.
How do you not consider this a how do you consider this to not be how do you consider this to be minimally intrusive?
Well, clearly it's a person who either A, doesn't know any better, or doesn't care. If you've ever had one of these strapped to you, and you've had beeps going off, and you've had to go outside buildings to establish satellite contact, and you've had the embarrassment of not being able to get into a pool because you've got this thing strapped on you, it's not minimally inconvenient at all. It's very invasive.
Seems to be incredibly short-sighted that someone would say it's minimally intrusive.
Well, the opinion is 108 pages counting the dissent. The majority opinion is 68 pages, I believe, and I read about 40 pages and got exhausted, and so I skip read the remaining of the majority. I didn't read the dissent because it's no longer relevant as far as I'm concerned because it's the highest court. So who gives a shit about the dissent? Yeah, well, that's the way I look at it. When you're at the highest tribunal, either the state or your Supreme Court, the dissent is only important in terms of if the court is really tightly balanced, and that one change on the dissent could change it to shift the other way. Then the dissent is very important. If you're 5-4, you see one vote can switch it. But if it's a 7-2, 8-1, who cares about the dissent? The dissenting judge is an outlier. But in this case, is over with. It's already gone through the U.S. Supreme Court. The statute has been declared unconstitutional, as it applies to that category of those who are covered, just to that category, the people who have paid their debt to society, and who have no further obligations. And this is important for our listeners to recognize. You heard old Larry say through the years, if you've been a follower of mine, that the best line of attack on this is that you might be able to do some of these things to people while they're being punished, but you can't do these things in a regulatory scheme after people have completed paying their debt to society. The Supreme Court said that in Packingham. They said you cannot do this restriction on the internet. And we're very troubled by this because you're applying it to people who have paid their debt in full. And this decision, they talk about that this guy had all of his rights restored except for his firearm rights. And then all of a sudden they say, we're going to search and seize you 24 hours a day. We're going to have an officer come visit with you every 3 months to check the equipment. And we're going to prosecute you for criminality if you don't cooperate with this intrusion and this constant surveillance. And he said, I think not.
Right. Well, very good. Larry, how can people get information? How can people get like the super deep dive, the insider story on what's going to happen with these three cases?
Well, they can become, what do you call it? We've got
patrons.
Well, not a patron, but I was trying to pick the lowest level. It's not the beggar.
Oh, indigent.
The indigent. You can become an indigent supporter. Of course, we'd prefer that you become, what is my level of support? You become a full paycheck. But yeah.
I'll have to go keep talking a minute. I'll find exactly what it's called.
Yeah. So
I created it. I just don't remember what it is. Someone says net pay. We have the advised. That's what it is. Cause you are going to advise them personally.
Oh, that's not what that is.
Yes, that is what that is.
I don't think we should call it advised cause I don't give advice really, but all right. If you say so.
Well, that's what it's called. It says this tier gives you access to have a private hour session with Larry.
Wow.
Isn't it worth an hour? Yeah. How about that?
Anyway,
so sign up over at patreon.com/registrymatters and you can get the full, we're probably going to talk for maybe about 30 more minutes on these three cases. And that is a special treat for our patrons. And so watch for that in your Patreon feed. If not, then I guess, how else can people reach out to us, Larry? How can they, what's the website?
Don't ask me. I just work.
It's always crickets. It's registrymatters.co.
I just work here.
Registrymatters.co.
Only thing I remember is the telephone number.
Of course. Because that's how you want to talk to everybody. I just want to email, text me, never call me. But how can people reach out to the podcast?
That was 747-227-4477.
And do you know the email address?
I do. It's registrymatterscast@gmail.com.
Very good. And we were just talking about Patreon, so that's patreon.com/registrymatters. And I think that's it, and we'll see you over on the Patreon episode here in a couple minutes. See y'all later. Bye.
Good night.